So how was that? It's all right? If it was rubbish, you can say so. That's all right. It's good? Could you feel that energy, that fire? Like sometimes when you do it, like you can feel like, oh, I can take on anything now. It's really nice meditation. It's, you know, one of the things with the elements meditation, the fire meditation, it really, it really is quite personal, right? So each person will respond very differently. For some people, it's really useful to have like a fire there, and you can look at it and help. For some people, more feelings in the body. For some people, more imagination. And so there are different ways of looking at it. So I'm supposed to do a Dhamma talk now, and I thought maybe I might just talk a little bit more about these four elements. So it's like the fire is one of the four elements. So what do you think? Is that a good idea? Should I do that? Should I talk about anything else? No? Anyone got any better ideas? All right. If I just talk about like what I think is a good talk, I don't know what you guys are thinking. You know, you might be thinking something else. Anyway, whatever. Here we go. So I'm going to talk about the four elements. We call the four. What is it in Pali? What's the name in Pali? Does anyone know? Dhatu. Yeah, Dhatu. Yeah, they're called Dhatu or Mahabhuta. So four elements, and. What are they again? Hang on, I'm drawing a blank. Four of them. Fire is one, okay. Wind, water, earth. Okay, more or less in reverse order, but that's pretty much it. Okay, good. And in Pali, we're pushing it now. Earth is Patavi, thank you. Water? Apo, thank you. And fire? Tejo. And what was the last one again? Wind is Wayo. Okay. Patavi, Apo, Tejo, Wayo. Good, thank you for that. Helping me out in the spot there. So, four elements. Now, one thing about the elements that you have... So the four elements are taught a lot in the suttas, right? So many times Buddha taught, sometimes brief, right? Contemplate these four elements, that's it. But sometimes also some of the longest and most complicated, but also most beautiful suttas are also about the four elements. But there's one thing about the four elements which most people miss when, if you come to it from just a Buddhist perspective or from a modern perspective. You see, one of the things that I've learned... I've been a monk for nearly 30 years now, right? And I have learned very, very little, okay? Almost nothing, okay? But one of the very few things that I have learned is when we're thinking about trying to understand the Buddha's teachings, see, what we tend to do, see, the Buddha was 2,500 years ago, right? This is time, okay? Here's time, and Buddha was here, and we're here, and we go back there, right? And we see the face of the Buddha from that direction. Yes? We see the Buddha from that direction. But the Buddha was actually talking to people of his time. He wasn't talking to us, right? He was talking to people who had learnt before. So he, in a way, he was turning his face in the other direction. So if I hear about these four elements, right? First thing I think is, oh, actually, that's pretty much like what I learnt in high school. Because earth element, that's like solidity, yeah? Water element, like liquid. The vayo is the gas. And the heat element, right, actually is plasma, yeah? So plasma is the fourth state of matter. Not plasma as in like a blood plasma, but plasma as in like fire is actually made of plasma, like the fourth element of matter, fourth state of matter. I learned that, by the way, from a plasma scientist who was on my last retreat in Sri Lanka. So she explained to me what plasma was, so now I know what that is. So we tend to look at it from a scientific point of view, and it's actually in a quite matches quite well, right? That these sort of four states of matter match pretty well to how we think of things scientifically. But that's not how people that the Buddha was talking to was thinking about, right? That's not what they learnt in their school. What were they thinking about? For them, these things were gods. They were gods. They were divinities. And that shapes an important dimension of how we think about these four elements that we are going to miss if we approach it from a purely modern and secular and scientific point of view. What does it mean to say that these things are divinities? Well, some of these gods are more familiar than others, right? Mother Earth. Yes? We know this idea of Mother Earth. Patavi, that we use in Pali for the earth element, also is a word for the mother goddess, who is the earth, who is the bearer of all, and who upholds all her children. We are all her children living on this earth. And she, as the earth goddess, was a very powerful presence in the minds and in the consciousness of people at that time. And that changes the way you look at things. Yeah? It changes the way you look at things. Like if you just think of Earth as a pile of dirt, well, that's one way of looking at it. Sure, it's a pile of dirt. But if you think of the Earth as a goddess, as your mother, then surely that's going to change the way that you relate to her. Yeah? A couple of years ago, actually, just time has gone all wonky recently, hasn't it? I think just before COVID, I did a retreat out in Central Australia at an Aboriginal community, and it was a really interesting retreat, and I really learned a lot. And I sort of taught these four elements on this retreat, and one of the things that I kind of noticed, one of the things I learned about the earth element on that retreat. Like, so you're out there in Central Australia, right? It's red dust everywhere. You know, you're sleeping on a swag in the dirt and all of these kinds of things. But you realize that the earth isn't actually dirty. Did you notice that? Earth isn't dirty. It's actually just kind of fine. And like we make it become something dirty because we try to exclude it. And we sort of turn it away and we pollute it with all of this junk and all of these chemicals and things. But actually just natural dirt is actually quite nice. And you just pick it up and hold it. And it feels, it's actually quite beautiful. And that's that contemplation of the earth element. There's something beautiful and something magnetic, something almost divine in the way that we can relate to that earth. And so if we think of these elements as merely material properties, then we miss a whole dimension of what they mean. In that community, one of the other things that I learned is, of course, you learn all these stories about the different, about the hills, about the creeks, the water, and all of these things. And so everything that's around you is infused with meaning. Of course, this is one of the things which we have tended to strip in our modern world, haven't we? We tend to treat the natural world as something that we can chop up, crush, refine, manipulate, and turn it into something that's nice for us. And we have forgotten that there is a divinity in this. Now, just as the earth is a divinity, also the water is a divinity. Yeah? In ancient Indian culture, for example, the river Ganges is a great goddess. Yeah? I mean, have you seen the Ganges? Have you been to India? Of course it's a goddess, right? It's a magnificent, incredible thing that just brings life to so many thousands and thousands of people. And with that power and that just that beauty and that presence. And so water is not just something, it's not just H2O. Yeah? It's not just an assemblage of some atomic particles and so on. Of course, it is those things. Right? I'm not saying that science is wrong. It is those things, absolutely. But it's not just those things. It's also life. And water is what brings life to, in the Buddha's time and place, to the whole land and to the whole of the Ganges Valley. But also very fickle, right? Flood was also a huge problem. If you've been to where the Buddha was enlightened in Bodh Gaya, you might have seen, depending on the time of the year, that there's the Naranjara River nearby, which is quite a broad, shallow river. But depending on the season, sometimes it'll be completely empty. And then other seasons, it's a flowing, full river. Yeah, and that's just because of the runoff from the Himalayas. So Apo, yeah, is capricious. Yeah. Brings life and can also bring death. Yeah. Of course, living in Australia these last few years, we don't really need a reminder of that. Yeah. We've seen both of those extremes of drought and then of the terrible floods that we've had for the last few years in the eastern seaboard. So when we say that these things are divine, we're not necessarily saying they're always good, right? Gods are tricky and capricious and not to be messed with. Fire, of course, is another one, right? Fire, the warmth of the sun. Yeah. The hearth that cooks our food for us. Yeah. The warmth inside our own human body. All of these things are beneficent and life-giving. But fire also, very dangerous. In the Buddha's time, yeah, they also had bushfires. There's even chants that we can do. That's why we have chants in Pali, you know. When the fires are burning down in Serpentine, the monks will do the Mora Parita, hoping the fire doesn't come. Doesn't usually work, well, doesn't always work, but anyway, we do our best. Because they had huge fires in the Buddha's time as well. And the god of fire, the deity of fire, of course, in the Vedic times was usually called Agni. And Agni was the main one who you made offerings to. But Agni has a very special place in the gods and as a divinity, because Agni is about change. And fire is what, it's not just what burns in nature, but when we can control fire, this is how we create technology. Right? That's how you smelt iron. It's how you make pottery. It's how you ultimately build a world-spanning industrial empire. Yeah? This is fire. And air, yeah. Also Vayu, a deity, a god, the gods of the storms and the clouds, the winds, that's bringing us life, bringing us air so we can breathe, but also threatening and dangerous and not to be trifled with. So Vayu itself is another that deity of movement and is another deity that brings us life, but it can also take away life. So this is how those deities or those properties were considered and treated. There would be hymns sung to them, rituals done in the name, sacrifices offered to them to make sure that the rain fell in the right season and not in the wrong season. To make sure that the heat was hot in the hot season and not in the cold season. To make sure that life could continue on in a sense of balance. So we've kind of decided to stop praying to those gods. I don't know, how's that going? Maybe we need to start. And of course, you know, as you know, the last few weeks we've had, you know, record-breaking temperatures across much of the world. Asia's been baking for months now. More recently, 50 degrees in China, 50 degrees in Spain, 50 degrees in Arizona. It's not normal. Someone's upset. Yeah, actually in the suttas, when it talks about these elements, these external elements becoming imbalanced, it uses the word kupati. And kupati both means to be like disturbed. It kind of means like the English word disturbed. It's like you're disturbed, but also kind of a bit angry, you know? And so these elements can get upset when they come out of balance. So when the Buddha spoke to these elements, then he was speaking in a culture where that understanding of these things as a divinity was taken for granted. That's the norm. And so the Buddha didn't usually talk about them in that way. Okay? It doesn't mean that that's not relevant or meaningful. It means that it's so taken for granted that you didn't have to bother stating it. And so that what the Buddha wanted us to do was rather than, he didn't want us to go worshipping gods. He didn't want us to be writing hymns in praise of them or developing metaphysics about them or anything like that. What he wanted us to do was to experience these things inside ourselves. And so for the Buddha, these four elements are the experience of properties. Experience of heat, the experience of solidity, the experiences of movement, the experience of cohesion, liquidity, the water element. So in a way, you know, you can say, well, this is kind of a reductive teaching because it's getting rid of that idea of these being gods or divinities or whatever. But in another way, you can say, well, it's actually about seeing that within yourself. Because you're seeing that you are not separate from those things. And the teaching on the four elements, it always goes the same way. Because it's always ajhatam bahidha, ajhata bahidha, internally, externally. And then the last one, internally, externally. Yeah? Inside, outside. Yeah? These same properties that we experience inside ourselves are the same properties you feel that are going on in the world around you. And we can experience them in here, and we can experience them out there, and we can dissolve the difference until what is in here and what is out there is just the same thing. And so the Buddha's teaching is always moving towards a dissolution of this distinction. So when we come to meditate, I'll talk a little bit about meditation on the different elements. So we just did the fire element, and we can meditate on each of the four elements in a similar kind of way. So in each case, there are two aspects of the meditation, the knowing of it and the seeing of it, okay? And different meditators will emphasize different perspectives, okay? So some people, and I myself, I'm very much in this sort of group, we tend to experience meditation as sensations that you feel inside your body, right? So when I meditate on these elements, I feel that heat, I feel that solidity, I feel that air. Other people will meditate, they will more see things. So you may be meditating, you actually see that fire burning, and you have like a vision of what's happening. Both of these approaches to meditation are taught in the suttas. Both of them are equally good, but it's just a matter of different characteristics, right? Different personal characteristics. Actually, these teachings on the four meditations is the most complex teachings on meditation in the suttas. Also in the Visuddhimagga, the Theravada meditation manual, the section on the elements meditation is far longer than any other meditation. And that's showing you how many different ways that you can pursue this kind of meditation. So I'm going to talk about a couple of different approaches to this these meditations for this evening, but by far from exhausting the different kinds of approaches. So if we take that path of knowing that that feeling of the different elements, we can begin by isolating them and isolating the different properties. And you can feel that sense of the earth element, which is the solidity inside your body, and you can feel it in your bones, in your teeth, in your nails. So to begin the meditation, always begin the meditation with the most simple and obvious thing, right? Take your time, yeah? Whatever is the most obvious, if you want to meditate on the earth element, you focus on what is the most obvious solid thing inside your body. Typically, that's your teeth, because you can feel the teeth very clearly inside your mouth. So you can focus on your teeth as being an aspect of the earth element, yeah? And then extend that perception through your body. And it's a bit weird, because what you find when you do that is that you can actually feel your bones inside your body. Did you know that? Like, we don't normally notice the bones, do we? We just sort of clomp around the place. But you can actually start to... Actually, they make a sensation, and you can play around with that sensation. So you can, if you get a clear perception of those bones, you can say, well, what happens if I was to take them out? And so you can take out your bones one by one and put them in a pile next to you. Yeah. And put... That would definitely feel different, wouldn't it? If you had no bones, yes. So you can feel these things inside your body. And so that through the meditation, you're tuning your perception, you're refining your perception until you can notice that. And so somebody who was going the avenue of knowing would then experience those, that feeling of that solidity. But somebody who was coming more from the aspect of seeing, who had more of a visual perception in meditation, then they would see their own skeleton. Yeah. So when you're beginning the meditation, if you are a seer, right, if you're someone who sees things in meditation, then visualize your own skeleton. And take your time, each part of the skeleton as detailed as you can until you get as clear an image of your skeleton. Sometimes you can see your skeleton sitting there so clearly it can even like start to glow. And you can feel like the whiteness of the skeleton starts to give off a kind of light. And so this is how it can start to lead your mind into samadhi. So as a rule with these meditations, they always move from what is obvious and what is multiple towards what is subtle and what is single. Yeah? So you start out contemplating the different aspects of the experience of these elements and focus on what you can feel the most. And gradually, as time goes on, your perception becomes more refined and more focused and more still until you're seeing just one subtle aspect of them. And that's how the meditations go, and that's how they will lead your mind into samadhi. So earth element, water element, same thing. When you begin the water element practice, you begin by focusing on what is the most obvious, usually the saliva in your mouth. And you can actually feel that in your mouth. And it's a very obvious example of the water element. And then you go from there, think about like the wetness of your eyes. Yeah, and just go through the different parts of your body. Same thing, you can try, if you're not sure what that water feels like, imagine what your body would be like without it. Yeah, just a dried up, withered old husk. Yes, just like your hopes and dreams, just like gone, like a husk. It's a joke, okay, fine. So, So, because of course our bodies are mostly water, right? And then the same thing, that you can connect this water inside you with that water outside. It's amazing, actually. One time when I was flying into WA, happened to fly over northern WA just after rainfall in the desert. And it was one of the most stunning and moving things that I've ever seen in my life, because you could look down on the desert and it looked just like veins. It looked exactly like human veins in your body, is the movement of water through the desert. And you realize this is what the Buddha was meaning. Like we are just a part of this system. We're not something which is separate from it. We're just like this little node, you know, of connectivity in the midst of this much greater system of water. So this is that contemplation on the water element, another divinity which is literally coursing through our blood. Then air. Now air is interesting, because air, if you want to meditate on air, you can't really look at it, right? So the earth element and the water element, you can also meditate on them by looking, right? So this is another way you can put like a glass of water and just focus on the water element and say to yourself, water, water, water. So again, this is an example of the external water element, and you can focus on that and then apply it inside, similar with the earth element. But with the air element, you can't, it's a bit hard to do that, right? You just got to, well, you tend to kind of look through it, so there's not much to look at. Right? But you can very much experience that inside your body. So the earth element inside your body, most obviously, is your breath, the movement of your breath coming in and out. Yeah? Actually, mindfulness of breathing meditation can be understood as a specialized form of the four elements meditation. So you can see that air element moving through your body. But it's also understood as not just the literal air, but also the energies that are moving in your body. And so when you sit, you know, one of the most striking and overwhelming experiences of any meditator is the feeling of these different energies, tensions, anxieties that are kind of like a bubbling away inside your body all the time, moving down these different channels and so on. And so this is understood also in Indian tradition as being part of the air element, that element of movement. So you can feel that movement coursing through your body. Each time we breathe in, we bring that external earth element inside ourselves. And each time we breathe out, we are moving our internal earth element, air element, to the outside. And what that means is, well, has many consequences. One consequence is that since we've all been sitting here together in this room for an hour or so now, we're all breathing in each other's air. Right? So part of me, literally, has been in your lungs. We're all sharing, yeah? We're all sharing. We're breathing in oxygen, breathing out CO2, contributing to global warming with each breath, adding just a little bit of CO2 to the atmosphere. This is another reason why we should do a lot of mindfulness of breathing meditation, because then your breath slows down and you're making less contribution to global warming. If everybody, think about it, if everybody on the planet meditated every day, I think there'd be a lot less CO2 in the atmosphere. Anyway. So the air element is constantly dissolving these boundaries between the inside and the outside. Yeah? It's one of the reasons why mindfulness of breathing is such a peaceful meditation. What it's doing each time you breathe in and out is you're dissolving your sense of self. Yeah? blowing it away. Yeah. And fire element, we've already talked about. I talked about that in the meditation previously. So again, we can do that as an external practice. You can watching a fire in a fireplace or something like that, but also through experiencing that temperature inside yourself. Now, as well as having these different modes of practice, right? So practicing by through knowing and practicing through seeing. Also practicing internally, practicing externally. You can practice using a material object. You can also practice using your imagination. You know? Imagining that fire. It's what we did during the fire meditation earlier. We imagined that fire inside ourselves. So these are all different meditations that are using your mind in slightly different ways. But these meditations also have another dimension, which is that the different elements tend to suit different personalities or different characters. And so some people might find themselves drawn to the fire. Some are drawn to water. Yeah? Some people just love to go and sit by the river, sit by the lake, and just, you know, always drawn to that. So think about yourself and think about your personality and what you feel that connection with. Yeah, if you're not sure, try them all and see how you go. However, it's not always the case that you should be go and practice the one that you feel drawn to. Yeah? Because balance in all things. Yeah? If you are too much of one way or the other, yeah, maybe you're too angry, too much fire inside your belly, then maybe you need to be doing some water meditation to cool down. Yeah. In spiritual circles, typically, you get a lot of people who are very airy. Yeah, a lot of air element. They tend to be, they walk into the room and they're kind of floating a couple of inches above the floor. Yeah, and so this is, and people like that, that's literally what the word spirit means. I mean, spirit means the air. And so people often have that tendency where they're very kind of up in the clouds, maybe not very kind of practical, not very grounded and so on. And that kind of person is drawn to spiritual circles and is also easily influenced. Yeah? They're in the air element, they can be blown around like this. Great for if you want to start a cult. Just tip, if you ever want to start a cult. So you want people who have that kind of air element energy, right? Because then you can guide them the way that you want and mold them the way that you want. Yeah? But if you're actually a genuine spiritual teacher, then you know, you'd want to try to emphasize the earth element for that kind of person. Right? So you might tell them, like when I was running a monastery, you know, if somebody who was like that, you know, and they'd be like, oh, they'd come in and they'd like, oh, look at the candles and look at these things and so on. I'd say, oh, that's nice. Can you go and empty out the trash? Yeah? Can you go and dig in the garden? Yeah? Can you go and actually do something literally in the dirt and get grounded with something practical? And sometimes I even recommend to people that they go and go to the beach and like bury themselves in the sand. Dig a hole and just bury yourself in the dirt. Because that actual feeling of those elements can have that impression and ground you. So this again is a kind of another nuance in how you approach these practices. Right? So the one that you feel the affinity for, that's good. It's good to connect with the one you feel the affinity for because that's your character. But when it's in balance, not if it's extreme or if it's out of balance. And if it's extreme or out of balance, then you need to you can also use them as like a counter medicine for those different kinds of imbalances. And I mentioned before the way that the Buddha used the word kupati to be upset or be disturbed of these elements. And so the Buddha didn't just talk about them like internally and externally and in all of these different ways that I've talked about. So we've already looked at quite a lot of different dimensions, haven't we? The internal elements, external elements, the meditation based on knowing, the meditations based on seeing, the different the different kind of ways of perceiving and practicing these elements. You can also practice the elements in as like countermeasures and in relationship to each other and so on. But that even that doesn't exhaust the way the Buddha talked about it, because the Buddha also talked about these elements in time. Right? So all of these elements are impermanent, and so they change over time. Last time I was in Perth, I happened to a friend of mine arranged a meeting with Dr. Noel Nanup, who's a Indigenous elder who works at the Edith Cowan University. And as it happened, Nanup is the people from my maternal grandparents' hometown of Geraldton. And we went to see him, meet Noel, and said, oh, you might remember my granddad, Ned Pinder. And he said, oh, yeah, you look like him. By which I think he meant fat and bald and white. So I don't know. Anyway, so Noel, when we sat down to talk, we talk about, just about different philosophies and things. And the first thing that he said was, he said, so you have to understand that for Aboriginal people, the most important thing is impermanence. I was like, really? Because the Buddha said something about that as well. And he said, that's how you understand everything, and how you understand nature. Like, nature is never something that's static, and the world around you is never something that's static. So you're always looking at the changes in the seasons, or how the wind is blowing in a particular direction, or how the sun is shining, or where the birds are singing, and all of the changes is what you're observing. And that's where meaning comes from. And he talked about this quite a lot, and about the different ways, like you watch, he talked about the migratory patterns of the eagles and how you'd see them flying through the different directions and so on. And so all of these things change over time. We have this tendency to think of ourselves as kind of just here in this world that's going on around us, as we're kind of independent of this world. And this kind of idea that somehow this world is, you know, it just goes on. You know? But it doesn't just go on. It's constantly changing. And it's constantly changing because of all kinds of things. I mentioned before that I'd been on this a retreat in Central Australia, and some of the experiences really stayed with me. One experience that I had was when we finished the talk, and I was walking back to where I was sleeping. So everyone was like, you know, you'd have like this little sort of camping ground, and people would put down their swags and they'd sleep in the swags and things there. But because I guess, never like to do what everyone else is doing or whatever. So I'd found a creek like a couple of kilometres away where I put my swag, and I'd sort of go and sleep in this dry creek bed. So anyway, so I'm walking down to this creek bed. And this is nighttime, right? Of course. And there's no moon, right? Completely no moon at all. I'm walking along and I've got my torch on. And then as I was walking along the road, I realized, why do I have my torch on? And I switched it off. And everything was just like perfectly lit around me. And I looked up at the stars. And the stars were so bright that, I'm not kidding. I literally staggered and almost fell over. It just this cathedral of lights, of all of these different colours, just dazzling, shining in the sky. And everything around me, you just see it. It's not like anything hidden. It's just this, everything around is just lit up. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, you know, I'm from Australia, right? We have a pretty good night sky, you know, especially if you get out of the city, you can see the stars and things like that. Even in the city, you can see the stars reasonably well. But I'd never seen anything like that. It was just so staggering. Anyway, in the morning I went in and I'd have a cup of tea with one of the guys from the community there who was our guide, and just sort of sitting there, and he just said, "It's really bright last night, wasn't it?" I'm like, "Yeah, it was, yeah." Don't know what it was, some strange atmospheric thing. And so you had this kind of perception of this kind of timelessness and beauty of nature that was just there, you know? But I also had this other thing that really struck me, and that was, again, a conversation with the guy who was the guide there. And we're just sitting there in the morning, and you're looking out over the grass, and it's just, you know, it's beautiful in the Australian outback. You know, there's some cliffs and rocks in the distance, and there's a few trees, and there's just nothing, you know? And you've just driven so far, come so far down all of these lonely highways to come to this little community on the edge of absolutely nowhere and this pristine, pure, untouched land. And we're sitting there, and he with our guide, he's like, he's not that old, he's in his 30s or something like that. And he just sort of casually said, you know, he said, "Everything here is different than when I was a boy." What do you mean everything's different? He said, "Everything here is different." "What do you mean?" He said, "These grasses, none of these grasses belong here. Yeah. These are all African grasses. Yeah. The cattle farmers bring them in. Yeah. All the Australian grasses are gone." He said, "The insects, if you listen, you can't hear the insects anymore." Yeah. He said, "Dingoes, we used to hear dingoes, can't hear them anymore. Yeah. The birds we could hear, you know, they've changed or they've gone." Yeah. And we don't realize this. We don't realize the change that's happened. My friend Venerable Akaliko just came back. He also spent some time just on an Aboriginal community in northern part of South Australia. He said the same thing there, that the grasses all around have been gone, and they're just these African grasses. And he said one of the effects that has is you can see the malnutrition of the people because they can't hunt anymore. All their animals have gone, everything that they used to eat. Yeah, it's gone. This is a change. This is that impermanence. And so we, humanity, and especially industrial humanity, are having profound impact on the world all around us. We used to believe that we were alive and had a living spirit, a living connection, a living meaning to find in this world. And whether you think of that in terms of divinities and gods and goddesses, or whether you think of it in terms of scientific paradigms of ecosystems and networks or whatever, it doesn't really matter too much. These are just ways that we come to grips with it. But the reality is that we are not separate. And the reality is that none of this is staying the same. So our impermanence and the impermanence of the world outside is the defining feature of our life. Yeah. As Dharma practitioners, we learn to accept that. We know that impermanence is inescapable. We know that our time on this earth will come to an end. And we also know as Dharma practitioners that we have a certain humility. We can't fix everything. We can't change everyone. Yeah. That's dukkha, that's suffering. But what we can do is what we choose to do. We can choose to live our life better. Yeah? We can choose to do less harm. We can choose to live a life that's meaningful. We can choose to live a life that is in tune with and that resonates with the earth around us and everyone and the spirits and the energies that are all around us. We live in challenging times, folks. Anyway, I'm going to leave it there and maybe leave some time for some questions. I don't know how we do things these days, whether we still have questions online or we're going to do that. Okay. Prem. Prem, he's an expert in the Apo Dhatu.
Thank you, Ajahn. Welcome home.
Thank you, Prem.
And let's hope you come here more often now. No, there's no COVID. I have a few comments, but I'll limit it to one or two. Which one? Not only meditation, but medication as well.
Right.
Like Ayurvedic and other Eastern medications use these four elements, isn't
right.
it? And the diseases are also classified in right. terms of, I'm not an expert, I've just heard that yeah. there is such a thing. It may be interesting to do some study on that.
Yeah, that's correct. Like so you know, I'm not an expert in Ayurveda, but again, and it's always that same thing of looking for balance. Like in Buddhism, like the four elements are regarded, they're always present. So you never have like pure one or the other. Like even this is water, but that water element also has heat in it. And it also has movement, so the four elements are always there. But so good health is regarded as being having a balance of those elements. Yeah.
Thank you, Ajahn. And the other one is the impermanence.
Yeah.
You started off by saying the fire meditation is contemplation of an aspect of impermanence.
Yeah.
So again, it stuck to me. Okay, how is it going to be similar to the impermanence that we contemplate in death meditation?
Right.
So it looks like it's another different way of looking at it, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, you know, quite literally, of course, fire is what brings about change, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, let's say you don't want to be impermanent. Okay, you want to live forever, and so what do you do? Well, you freeze your body. Yeah, take the fire element out and then wait for science to advance so that we can give you a new body that's going to live forever or whatever. So that's how you do it. So literally, or you know, more prosaically, if you want to preserve food, you put it in the freezer. So you remove the fire element and that slows down impermanence.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ajahn. Nice to see you back.
Okay. Good.
Ajahn,
yes.
With the elements, is the Buddha referring to the different states of matter?
Sure. Yeah, but sure. But like as I said, like don't how do I put this? I think it's important to remember that these teachings have many dimensions, and so that's like one dimension or one aspect, a way of looking at it. Which kind of makes sense to us because we're brought up on a scientific education, so that's an avenue to it which is going to be meaningful to us. So that's a kind of a, I wouldn't necessarily say it's the same thing, but it's certainly a way of looking at it. Yeah. Okay. I might just take a couple of the questions from online. How's it going, online folks? How's life in cyberspace? Okay, so here I have a question from Sydney. How come I come all the way here to Perth and then get a question from Sydney? It's crazy. This world, I don't know. If you are in Sydney, just in case you didn't know, I'm doing talks normally in Sydney at Harris Park Community Centre, Friday night, 7 o'clock. Be there or be square. Also, Crow's Nest Community Centre at 7 o'clock. So, Sydney random person, if you're not already coming to those talks, hopefully we'll see you there sometime. Also, folks here, like we sometimes get friends from Perth come over. So, if you are coming to Sydney ever, you've got some friends there. Come and see us. It's nice. Okay. So, question from them. How to rebuild and reignite one's own fire when overwhelming life experiences have caused it to burn out? I'm so sorry to hear that. Yeah? I'm so sorry to hear that. And I can hear in that question like this sense of kind of struggle or almost despair, right? So I guess that if we're going to pursue that metaphor, then when the fire has passed over the land and scarred everything and reduced it all to ashes, what we look forward to is some rain. Yeah, a nice, beautiful, soft rain, cool water that's going to come there. So if you're feeling like that, if you're feeling scarred and burned out and so on, don't be in too much of a hurry to reignite those flames again. Right? Maybe you feel like, oh, you're missing the energy that you used to have or the enthusiasm or something like that. Very understandable. But rather than trying to sort of build that fire up right away, maybe it's time for a little the water of love, a bit of compassion, a bit of gentleness, yeah? And then to give the ground of your mind and body time to regenerate. The good news is that our mind, just like our body, is a self-healing organism. And whatever trauma or scar or anything that happens to you, your mind is already starting to heal from that. And so what we need to do is give our mind the space to be able to do it. And that comes from love. So maybe if that's the case, maybe try some water meditation or maybe some metta meditation. All right, question from Bolivia. How's it going, Bolivia? I assume the place Bolivia, rather than a person called Bolivia, but whatever. How's things in Bolivia? I've never been. I hope life is going good for you there. So can the four elements meditation be used to reduce desire in meditation? Or is the meditation of the 31 parts of the body more effective? How to reduce karma, chanda? Thank you. Okay, so one of the methods of meditation that we can use is to counteract desire or lust. This is a lesson that I learned about meditation. One of the first lessons that I learned when I was in Thailand, the first retreat I did with Wat Rampung in northern Thailand, near Chiang Mai. And, went and doing the retreat and so on. And then one of the first times I talked to a monk, actually, and there was this monk, Thai monk, sitting around, and we went up and talked to him. And for some reason, he was doing this meditation or something, and he just said, oh, the body is ugly. I never heard this before. He said, the body is ugly. I'm like, speak for yourself, mate. Mine's all right. And but of course, this is the thing, is that we tend to either go to one extreme or the other, don't we? Is we tend to get like really attached to our body, and we like to dress it up and put makeup and make it look really beautiful and get really attached to it. Or we tend to get really negative about our body. We think, bad self-image or whatever, and we can become very kind of anxious about it as well. So the Buddha again taught these meditations to try to sort of balance these things out. So we can, if you're feeling it, too much desire, too much lust, too much attachment to the body, then you can do these kinds of meditations. And to answer directly the question, then yes, sure, you can do these meditations, and these will also help to do that as well. So either way is fine. Again, it really depends on your personality. It's difficult to make a sort of general prescription about these things. Okay. So a question from Dhirayupa. How's it going, Dhirayupa? I hope Melbourne's treating you well, Victoria's treating you well. I've been told that when we look at a fire for fire meditation, we have to make sure that the fire or part of the fire that we're looking at is not flickering. Is this point really that important? No. You don't have to find a fire that doesn't flicker is difficult. Part of the fire element is the fact of impermanence. So when you're looking at it, there is that flickering and that movement. So you should, the sort of classical recommendation is that you build a fire, if you want to use an external fire for meditation, you build a fire in a place that's sheltered from the wind so that it's not flickering and moving too much, right? And you supply it with enough clean fuel so that it burns with a fairly steady and clean flame. All right? So you don't want something that's too flickering and too changeable, but generally speaking, you want something that you can focus on that area of the fire and you know, get a good focus on that there. So it's kind of partially true, but not completely the case. Are there practitioners who do meditation on the four elements? So it's next question from Indira. How's it going, Indira? Hope things are well. Are there practitioners who do meditation on the four elements their main practice to understand the Dhamma fully? Look, these days, I honestly, I don't know. Maybe there are. Most people that I know would do it as a sort of supplementary practice to along with other meditations. Certainly there may well be. There's no reason why you can't if that's what you want to do. Okay, so a comment. Somebody commenting about during the fire element meditation, the breath became very prominent because it felt very cool relative to the heat in the body, and they enjoyed it a lot. Well, that's really good, and that's exactly what that meditation's about, because you're noticing those properties, which, you know, they're there all the time, right? The coolness of the breath and the heat and so on. It's always there, but now you're starting to become more aware of it. And this is one of the signs that your meditation's progressing. You know, just before we were came into the meditation, we were talking to a couple of people about their meditation, and someone's saying they're meditating and their mind's too distracted and their mind's too busy. And I'm like, do you think your mind's less distracted when you're not meditating? So when your mind is thinking and distracted in meditation, don't see that as a problem. That's not a problem. That's wisdom. That's awareness. That's for you knowing what's happening. Yeah? That's the first step. So to be aware that your mind is thinking and distracted and everything, this is good. You're aware of it. Yeah? So just be patient. Don't be discouraged. All right? Don't be discouraged no matter what's happening. Just stick it out. Be patient. And what you'll find is that sometimes, even like in the whole meditation, you might feel like your mind is wandering and there's no focus or anything like that. But this is why, at the end, why you do that reviewing, check back over the meditation. Because what you'll find is that, actually my mind is more peaceful now than it was at the beginning. Yeah. Yeah. This is the aspect of the Dhamma, the ehipassika, that you can see it for yourself. Okay. So I think that's about it. Is that right? Okay, good. Great to spend some time with you. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming and sharing your breath with me. I've enjoyed it very much. I'll be here over the weekend. We're doing the course with Venerable Brahmali and Venerable Sunyo, so that should be fun. I just heard that I'm doing tomorrow afternoon meditation as well, so that also should be fun. And I'll be here next weekend as well, and then I'm going back to Sydney for the Vasa. Yeah. Good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Do you have any more announcements to make or anything? No? We're good? Shall we finish up?
Let's pay respects.